Right. So Saturn, which means melancholy, which means the darkness, which means time process, also means wisdom. So you see the figure of Saturn, Kronos, the temporal process, symbolizing wisdom. But the wisdom of accumulated serial experiences. He doesn't want to fight anymore. If he meets a hero, he'll give him good advice. And if possible, he'll try to get the good advice in before the hero removes his head. So, there is a right there. The right of wisdom. You can see it in dogs, when you see a grey-haired dog with grey hairs around its mouth, walking along with a bit of rheumatism. Doesn't the rheumatism give dignity to that dog? And when you see the shambling gait of a puppy, it takes a bite of this old one. Doesn't this terrible rage of the once hero, which has been progressively condensed inside him because of his growing awareness that he's getting older and weaker, doesn't his rage and his self-examination and his desire to become powerful like he once was, which he knows he isn't and cannot be, does not all this become a terrible growling inside him? Doesn't he rely on growls to keep the young ones in order? Is this the meaning of the elder statesman? The ability to sound as if you can tear them to pieces, in spite of your rheumatism. So there's a right there, a correct thing to do. At that level, you have to be wise, learn to growl, lower the voice, to get rid of the Donald Piers from the voice or the Tiny Tim. Then we come on to the right of the comprehender. Tell me what it is, dear.
It's experience, it sounds through it, and it's the knowing that it will be your brain.
The knowing it will be your brain. Would that be an accumulation of experiences of actual obedience of other beings to the word?
Yes.
Yes, a growing confidence. So a person who is very wise, who has been a sufficiently violent hero, and seen enough deaths, and heard enough shouts, and had his eyes open, would see to which shouts, to which tones people had responded, then he could actually come to believe in the tone of authority, couldn't he? And then you would tend to believe him. It would be a growth of his experience. So there's a right there. And here is another right, the right of the comprehender. The man who does not operate apparently from experience, but from knowledge of the whole plan. Imagine a man who says, I know the plan of the universe. In India, he would be a Brahmin. A man who understands the broad Brahman needs to extend, to stretch out the broad issues of being, the broad issues of universal existence. The right there to have an air of having seen everything, so you don't need to go anywhere. Tell me something that's happening in the Amazon. I know about it. Tell me something that's happening on the river Po in Italy. I know about it. Tell me, don't waste your time telling me anything. I've been. It isn't worth it. I comprehend. Imagine an infinite sphere. And the right of that sphere is to assume a sort of spherical type expression, comprehending all things, so that even the growly voice of the one-time hero who has become a sage ascetic, even he cannot frighten the comprehender. The comprehender says, all things are cyclic. What he said to the great hero was, you will die. And you will go into a place called Hades, the land of the Shades. And in that land, all your heroism is nothing. Your weapons are nothing. You are merely shadows. Suppose you've been a great hero all your life and you've bashed everybody. And then you had to go into a place called Shade Land. And there you were just a shade. And the lowest man in the village was a shade. He wasn't more shady than you. He was just like you, the same. Two-dimensional. Pale. Are they happy? No. Are they miserable? No. They're nothing in shade. Can you imagine what it's like to be a shade in Hades? Agamemnon, Achilles, Ajax. Greater man, a greater muscle. I look, see. Horrible. I can see straight through my muscle. It's a shade. How do you feel? The comprehender says, all things are doomed, and they must go down. They must go into the land of Pluto. The land once ruled by Hermes. And they must there become subject. No longer great heroes. And the Lord of the cycle knows this. He knows the whole cycle. And he knows that being a shade in this way is a bit colourless. And all the great egotism of the great heroes is rendered null and void in this underworld, in the shades. And while he's busy intimidating everybody, this fellow bobs up. And he says, very nice. How about initiative? How about the resurrection? You've just told me about four ways of dying. Earth way of dying, water way of dying, fire way of dying, air way of dying. How about this? The will. I don't care about your repetition of cycles. In the ancient world, they had agricultural cycles. They knew the calendar inside out and backwards. They could predict solar eclipses. They could predict the flooding of the Nile. They could predict everything in the agricultural cycle, and they had intimidated everybody. One man said, no. This cycle was posited and is reposited by an act of will. And the man of will said, I ignore your cycle. I imagine the man of will, who ignored the cycle, was absolutely opposed to the four other modes. He was liberated from their inertias, from the repetitions, and he was free. What is the right for him? The right for him is a simple right, immediacy. There is no past, there is no future, there is here now the will to precipitate or not, at will, from the will of the will, mysteriously, with no explanation. Just posit something. What can those four do with him? Nothing. If they knew he existed, what would they do with him? Try to kill him. Now, that one, that thumb, the anthropologist would say, is a phallic symbol and is related to the Messiah, the resurrector. He who must rise again, the will, the eternal will, it comes up. No matter how often you knock it down, it comes up. And the person who is like that, centered in the will, he says, if you kill my body, if you give me pains, if you give me serial arguments, if you give me repetitive processes based on an eternal cycle within a spherical domain, I ignore them. If you kill me, I resurrect. The next moment, I'm up again. You can kill my body. You cannot kill my will, because my will has never been in existence as a form. My will is a power which is eternal. And you cannot get at it. The will of my will you cannot touch. Therefore, you can murder my body, you can hurt it, you can insult the thought processes. You can offer me erroneous ones in exchange. You can give me a new plan. I might say, no, qui bono. To whom the good? What is the meaning of your plan? I am a being of will. I do not need a plan. I need nothing. I am immediate. That is the Messiah, the Resurrector, who resurrects now, here, every moment. Now, to reach that level of awareness isn't very far away. An ordinary man goes up to middle finger. That is, he's got a body, pleasure pains, serial thinkings. He has not normally got a very clear governing concept. Karl Marx had a clear governing concept that the processes of human evolution in society had something to do with commodity necessity, development. That was one. Hegel had another one, a little earlier than Marx, that the universe was logical, that the rational is the real, the real is the rational, and cosmos is understandable in logical processes. Those are good ideas. They were good ideas, but idea is only form. The will generated the form. So St. Augustine with his doctrine of the will, Kierkegaard with his subjectivity is truth, Nietzsche with his doctrine of the will, they're beyond Hegel, they're beyond Marx, they're beyond any commune, any formal pattern. They're in the will. The right of the will to be immediate, to initiate, to give no explanations. Explanations are lower than the will. If somebody would like an explanation, they could have a handful. They're all irrelevant. The right of the will to be immediate. And it's only two steps up from the ordinary man. All the ordinary man has to do is get a governing concept. But the governing concept is not to be that there is a form that can save you. Forms build systems. The word system, system, means saviour for a time. But it does not save you eternally. Nothing saves you eternally except the will. So you're only two steps up. Get a governing concept, and let the governing concept be, I rest in my will, not in an idea. Julius Caesar had it. The cause is in my will. St. Augustine had it. Nietzsche had it. Blake had it. Babies have it, but not reflexively. Now the thing is to get it reflexively. Get your concept. But let your concept not be of an idea or a system that can make you secure. Because there is no security in time by a system, but temporarily. There is no permanence. But in the will, in the immediacy of here now, there is the only real salvation. So the right of the will is immediacy. And there, down in the will of the will, in the palm, in the hexon, in your angel, there is your real self. The will has its mysterious non-process, the mystery, the inexplicable, whereby it comes to whatever it does, without explanation. And there we see how rituals have developed. And all the particularized rituals, the details of ritual, like puberty rituals in primitive times, and rituals of towels and feathers, and rituals of painting noses red in engineering workshops, all those things are derivative from a primary concept. The concept that when you act, you create a difference. And the difference that you create, the letter R, crucifies you, the letter T, fixates you permanently. And when you know this and you rise through these four passive formal ways to the will, you then know that when you are willing, if you posit a form, you crucify yourself. But supposing you don't posit a form and lean on it, supposing that every form you posit is a fantasy. That is, you know it will dissolve. What does Kierkegaard say about that? Supposing you know that every coin you utter is a false one. That's the Indian doctrine of Maya. The will posits a form, but the form does not limit the will. The form is something that is posited there to make an appearance, a phenomenon, to capture the imagination of the capturable. But the will itself does not fall into identification. It remains will, hidden in itself. Now, in people ordinarily, non-reflexively, they're identified with their physical body as reference point, with their pleasures and pains when they're operative, with their mentation processes when they're asleep, and for part of their dream life also. They have very little comprehension and hardly any universal governing concept. But in this will of the will, there is this absolute freedom of immediacy. And there is an awareness that everything you do that is expressible, every concept you define formally, every reason you give serially, every cry of pleasure or pain, and every bruise on your body, all those things have been precipitated by the will as phenomena, as appearances. And they have no meaning, no more meaning than the shades in Hades, unless you will them to have meaning. Unless you will a form to have meaning, it has not. If another person wills a form for you, if I say to you all, vote for the common market, or say no, that's a form. It would come out of my will. If you thought there was any sense in it other than my will, you would be self-deceived, because it would be your will to believe, not mine for saying it. Now, people are very fond of believing things and then blaming somebody for leading them into it. You cannot be led into anything unless it is in conformity with your deep will. So then you recognize the true position, the true right of the will is this, that the whole universe is posited for each individual from within the individual, from the center of the will of the will, posited in all its details, including motor cars and houses. All these are posited by the will, and by the will they can be wiped out. If you identify with the thing posited, you go under the law governing the thing. If you do not, you do not go under that law. You remain a free being. Now, in this process of observing how the will can climb up from body awareness, and by initiation, remember the baby fell on his head first, to become individuated and separated from the mother, his head struck the ground, not hers. His own likes and dislikes, his own thoughts grew out of the pain. His individuation comes out of pain. This is a great meaning of ascetic existence thousands of years ago. By self-imposed penances, by deliberate self-suffering, by deliberate restraints, impositions of things we don't like, individuation grows. This individuation climbs up and up and up until finally it realizes itself in the reflexive will, and it recognizes that it, the will, posited the whole process, and that it has been working backwards into itself only because it forgot that once it was will, that the will posited for itself the concept, the pattern, the whole pattern of its life, and then went into the whole pattern, energized it, serialized it, so that that will then appeared in time. And then it clothed itself with the sun, the life power. And it took that life power, that clothing of the sun, and entered into a body of gross matter with it, and it posited those in that way. And then is forgotten. In the words of Plato, in the myth, choosing the lies, in that eternal, in the hexonic, you drink the waters of Lethe, of forgetfulness, and you enter into time to have an experience. What is it like to be symbiotic? What is it like to be in a mother, in another being, inside another being, so that your whole being is conditioned? Think what it's like. A will that was absolutely free posits itself into the total bondage of the uterus, where the mother's breathing, her diet, her quarrels, her pleasures, continuously affect through the biofield of this child internally. What is it like? You haven't got a mind of your own. You haven't got a will that is not interfered with by the will of this creature who is carrying you. You haven't got a body free from her processes. You haven't got a like or dislike that is not interfered with by hers. You are in utero. You are in what Freud thought was omnipotence, the omnipotent sense. You're all powerful. You're absolutely penetrated by your mother and her mother's 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 mother. The ancestors have got you. What is it like to be inside sphere upon sphere upon sphere upon sphere? Imagine each of the mothers, right back to the absolute, was a sphere. And each mother developed itself internally, a child which became a mother of a child, a mother of a child, a mother of a child. And right in the middle, sitting inside there, is the new baby. And he hasn't got anything. It isn't interfered with by everything. How can it be itself? So it has to say, out. We want out, Common Market. It has to launch itself, fall on its own head. It started the climb back. When it's gone through the whole process, back to the will, reflexively, we have proved it. When we were in the infinite, absolute, free spirit, which is God, says Christ, God is spirit, in that we didn't know what it meant to be absolutely conditioned. So we threw ourselves down. And the only way we can get into the time world in the living body is through a mother. So the spirits in the infinite are watching and looking at women, looking at men. And they keep a sharp eye on the boys and girls. And as soon as two get together, as soon as the sperm enters the egg, whoosh, down. That's for me.
And what's the difference between that uterine feeling as the precious of all else feeling and being in the hexonic field where you're
in? The difference is in the hexonic field you have no edges. You are absolutely penetrated, and in utero you are inside the amniotic sac, and you are aware of a pressure on your physical body that doesn't go through you like it does in the hexonic field. It hits on your body. You have a haptic sensation. Now in the hexonic field you don't have that. You have a mutual interflowing and passing through a transcendence, an absolute transcendence, the Jiji Munga. Reciprocal interpenetration of all beings, but no sense of haptic limit. But in utero you have that. And that is the whole process of the ritual. A ritual for every level, and the process whereby, if you remember it, you assume absolute responsibility for yourself. We move through the world, through time. The war is not over yet, the temporal war. There's another war. The external war, Muhammad called the little war. The internal war, whereby I fight my way through from all these dependencies to my reflexive free will, that he called the great war, the inner war. You climb up to this. Only one way, by continuous self-examination of body, of feeling, of thought process, of governing plan, and then reflexive awareness that you posited the plan. And until you do this, you will erroneously think that somebody else is responsible for your misery, or your happiness, your success, or your failure. In the next few years, we will see more and more and more of what Nietzsche prophesied and what the Revelation prophesies. Wars, rumors of wars, scatterings, dropouts, failures, and a gradual awareness in certain groups of people who are working towards it, who are self-elected by grace, and grace means the freedom of their own spirit at the top level, who are self-elected to carry themselves through the whole process, so that when the next big cataclysm strikes, many will panic, they will regress, because the natural thing when you get hurt is back to mama. But those who persist in this upward movement towards reflexiveness, they're going to have a different kind of future. They're going to have a permanent future, in which future means the law is established by the power of the will itself. Millions will perish. Those of you who saw that horrible Vietnam film last night have a rough idea, in a little measure, of what will happen in the future. Millions will perish, but those who focus upon this process and who remember that they threw themselves down into the body and they're climbing back up to reflexive awareness, they are the elect, self-elect by the inner spirit of God inside them. They will not panic. They won't regress and collapse. They will discover what Christ meant when he said, when he was told, make these stones into bread. Man does not live by bread alone. We are in a field of power. That power has posited this hexon, our real self. And that hexon has manifested itself in the individual will. And in that time of the testing, you will feel yourself fed by the power. You feel it around you, feeding through you. It will give you information about where to be when. It will give you resistance to all the epidemics, to all the diseases, to all the panic fears that will attack the unprepared. And if you persist to the end being reflexive self-consciousness, you will find that the energy in your being is self-renewing, self-resurrecting. The whole stress, the whole focus of your consciousness would not be in gross matter anymore. It would be in this field of intelligent power. You won't care what happens to you. They shoot a bullet through your head, and it passes through your head, and it heals. Because it's his only power. You know, during the last war, there was a pilot who got a wound in the head. He thought it was a surface wound. And he carried on. He landed his plane. He got out. He went to the MO. The MO looked. He said, you had a bullet through the head and the man dropped dead. That was inertia. He had the theory, bullet through head equals death. Now that kind of equation is death. But the other thing is, I lay my life down, I take it up again. That's what Christ tells you. If you go to my Father, that is to say to the whole field of sentient power, greater works than these shall you do, mendings of little odd bones and little blindnesses and so on there, you will do much greater than that. You will be able to reassemble yourself. You will be able to reposit yourself. This is the target. This is the goal. And the ritual for that is, remember self-positing. And repositing is your work. No one else's. You posit and reposit yourself momently. And each moment is new. Don't think you can posit yourself now for 5 minutes hence. You can't. You posit yourself in every split second. And what you posit in that split second, willfully, reflexively, you become in that instant. You actually synthesize the essential materials of your being as an act of will every moment. And when you do that, what have you got to worry about? Nothing. Where are we going to start?
When this baby was born to this early woman, how did she decide to separate it from her?
How did she decide? Mm. Well, she didn't. Go back to the beginning. We start with an infinite field of sentient power. Is that right? Cause means a blow struck, and blows are struck by power. So if you want to know what is the first cause, we have to go to an infinite power. Now, that infinite power, before there is any existential finite world, must be conceived to be an infinitely extended power, mustn't it? Then if there is to be a cause, that is a blow struck, upon what will it strike? It can only strike like this, can't it? It must contract itself, condense, and create a center by condensation. Condensation. Calm, dense, means with judgment issue. When it condenses, the field, which was free absolutely, becomes bound, doesn't it? Self-bound. Now, the field posits the original substance. The original substance name is Ma. You know what Ma means, don't you? The mother principle. The M-O in mother and the M-A in ma are the same. Except the M-O means the sphere. Encapsulation. The M-R means substantial activity. So you have a substantial sphere, M-O, and you have a substantial activity, because the sphere is only a sphere, because it is actually compressing itself. So the first mother, like the first hen, is laid by the field. The infinite field posits the mother. And having posited that zone of encapsulation, who is going to conduct the processes in it? When that field, which is viewed in this infinite sense, is considered, we are considering omnipotence, aren't we? All power. Now, all power is greater than any part power, isn't it? But if it condenses like this and makes a sphere, is that sphere not finite? And hasn't it dropped in potential? Hasn't it become less powerful by being condensed? If it is less powerful, and there is an infinite power beyond, and this infinite power beyond is intelligent power, sentient power, doesn't it follow that the one that is posited must be transparent to the one that posited it? Because the one that posited has higher potential. So the lower one must be transparent or permeable to the infinite. So then any process conducted inside the zone of encapsulation must be conducted by the infinite. So who delivers the baby? God. The field. Yeah? No finite can do it.
What about the free will, then?
this mother who could freely will not deliver the baby.
She can't freely will anything until she becomes reflexive. To be free is the product of work.
Could you relate dominion there then?
Dominion.
Dominion, because you have said that not even God can dominate man because they are atheists. So that the individual has a free will to reject even God.
God has posited a purpose. Yes, God has posited a purpose to make man free-willed. Mm-hmm. So that the free will that man has is by permission.
Once he gives us permission, then the individual has free will.
Momently. Because God posits everything like this.
That's the only free will there is.
Like this. Mm. The only free will there is, in the moment.
Yeah.
So only a momentary being has got it. And only moment by moment, in the reflexive act.
But in order to fulfill all righteousness, all things are possible. So the woman could have said no, or could still.
Only by absolute permission, because he posits her in the first place with the intent that she shall become reflexive.
So at that moment that he delivers, then she is, the will, her will and God's will are coincident.
Right.
At that moment.
Yes.
Of it can't be a decision, can it?
Well, decision means cutting from. There is certainly a cutting from. The thing to remember is this. Is it reflexive in the individual level?
So are you saying here, and I know you are, that a person becomes reflexively self-conscious by permission?
Called grace.
Or grace. And as you said, it doesn't matter how much work a person does, ultimately it is the absolute that opens the door.
Mm-hmm.
Can you clarify how, therefore, in order to move towards reflective self-consciousness, the person has to get hold of their own free will, and yet the will of the will is mysterious and free and can't be got hold of, and it depends upon the grace of God to do it anyway?
Well, that's in the parable of the prodigal son, isn't it? Because the prodigal son is a son who asks for his inheritance. He's given it before his father dies and goes into the world and spends it and goes right down till he's living with pigs, symbol of obstinacy, eating husks, symbol of externality and meaninglessness. And he turns around then because there's nowhere else to go. And he's gone where he was driven, into prodigality. So there, the will of God to give him the money to go with has actually posited him in the pigsty.
Yes, and at those lower three levels, he gets there.
Yes.
Right.
So then his turnaround is for him natural. He himself says, I have sinned against heaven and against my father, when he's sitting with the pigs.
Then is the turnaround the comprehension, and he has now transcended the mechanicality, or has he mechanically got to the turn and thinks the only place is to try it?
He mechanically got to the term of comprehension. And that's a question of whether in his comprehension he will turn back again upon himself. That's called dog returns to vomit.
So you're saying there that his return home was in fact a positive act, positive by himself,
Yes.
And not due to the external situation of living with the pigs.
Oh no, it wasn't due to the pigs.
Because, well, the opposite. He's taken into himself.
Yes, by divine grace. God posited him in the whole process down to the pigs for the express purpose of bringing him up to the point where, comprehending, he wills to return.
So he could have stayed at that level had it not been for the grace of God coming into him. He could have stayed there eternally.
Yes.
He depends on the grace of God.
Oh, yes.
Nothing he can do at the individuated.
Except wish he was out of it.
Yeah.
And be overlooked by the absolute, who decide whether or not he's sincere in wishing to be out of it, or whether he needs an extra turn of the screw.
No, it happens.
As far as the finite ego is concerned, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But remember this, that what you call anger, when you're identified with your finitude, is a tiny bit of the anger which is God the Father. And it means exactly the opposite.
The grace of God is within you anyway. If the anger is in you, the grace of God must be in you.
But it transcends you as well, absolutely, as a finite being. Just like your individual anger is yours, but that little zone of anger in you is just a little pocket of anger in the infinite anger of God the Father. Now, anger doesn't mean the same thing to God the Father that it means to a finite being, because finite beings don't like it, do they? And they think in their anger that if they smash some finite, they will get where they want to get. God's anger is exactly the opposite. His anger is an energy which dissolves rubbish. Whatever is not worth preserving, the anger of God consumes it, reduces it. That's right, super weed killer. Yeah. So that whereas in the case of the angry human being, he thinks if he smashes a few brothers and sisters or mothers-in-law or things, that he will have happiness, he's not trying to get rid of things that are no good, is he? He's trying to get rid of finite things that are getting in the way of his no good purposes. That's the exact opposite. The anger of God is quite simply that he spends a large amount of his time breaking down rubbish that has accumulated into primary energy. You know how if you eat a sprout, you attack it in your tummy and you break it down and you reduce it to non-sprout energy, don't you? And you then deploy that energy in your being intelligently for some organic purpose. Now in the same way, men are excreting, and have done so from the beginning of time, erroneous concepts, wrong emotions, and they pour these out into space, and they fall onto centers, and they make accumulations of nonsense and fantasy and misery, which sensitive people can pick up, and they can be made ill by them. The fire of the Absolute dissolves these, it digests them as surely as that acid in your tongue can digest your dinner. And it does so, wherever it decides to do so. But if a particular piece of rubbish is useful in a certain place to annoy somebody who needs a bit of prodigal experience, it moves it along to that person, so that person can have a rubbishy experience.
When Jesus says he can build a temple again in 3 days,
mm-hmm.
What you've been saying about the free will, Jesus put himself on his own cross in absolute balance,
mm-hmm.
And yet the free will of the absolute could have been for him not to resurrect.
Could have been, yes.
So how could Jesus say beforehand that he could?
Because he said, what the Father wills for me to do, that I do. Remember, it's only momentary. When he's on that cross, he's not thinking, tomorrow I'll be dead and buried, and the day after that I'll be resurrected. He knows what is happening now. And he's ready for God to change his mind.
If he's not to change his mind, and his earlier prophecy would not have been right, he couldn't have built a temple again in 3 days, could he?
Of course he could.
But he wouldn't.
How do you know?
Because if God freely had changed his mind, Jesus wouldn't have been resurrected off the cross in 3 days.
How do you know? He could have changed his mind again.
In free
will. No, he could have changed his mind again.
And again.
And again. Infinitely.
It would take a lot longer than 3 days.
No, not at all, because changing one's mind in eternity doesn't take time. See, what you're doing, you're importing serial thinking into the eternal.
I'm trying to understand free will.
Hmm. The will of the will you can't understand. It is immediately experienced. You can think about it as an unconditioned initiative. You can feel it very pleasant, free feeling. But to understand the will of the will, you cannot. Nobody, not even the Son of God, knows that.
But hasn't the will of the will still to commit it?
It doesn't have to do anything.
Well, to become existential, hasn't it to commit itself into the Logos, to serve the Logos, the form that is in existence?
It creates it. Existence is inside the Logos.
Yeah, and then commits itself to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then obeys it.
According to its own will, yes. And dissolves it and reobeys it. What you're doing there is imposing a conditioning process upon the will, which is absolutely free. The whole time scale can be altered. The length of days can be altered. Day can mean anything to the infinite power. The tendency is to import temporal thinking into eternal considerations, which loses the point of the paradox that eternity, which is not time, has time, seriality, in it, and that the decisions of the infinite are not penetrable by the finite, serial thinking mind. That's why to get to it you have to keep still. You have to stop the rationalizing process, still the mind, and re-experience the will of the will in consciousness. The whole time scale can be altered. The length of days can be altered. Day can mean anything to the infinite power. The tendency is to import temporal thinking into eternal considerations, which loses the point of the paradox that eternity, which is not time, has time, seriality, in it, and that the decisions of the infinite are not penetrable by the finite, serial thinking mind. That's why to get to it you have to keep still. You have to stop the rationalizing process, still the mind, and re-experience the will of the will in consciousness, momently.
When it reaches the level of comprehension, you have to serialize what you've comprehended.
No, you don't. You've already done that.
If you verbalize it.
Well, then, if you verbalize it externally, you're serializing the expression.
But you're not serializing it.
Mm-hmm. Internally you're still comprehending.
Yes.
With the external expression you would have serialized.
Yes.
But that wouldn't affect the simultaneity of your comprehension.
No.
And this is the paradox. That a thing that's in time takes what you call time, the thing you serialize, every moment of it, every turning, every orientation is simultaneous in eternity. So the problem is solved before it is posited. When we talk about God having gained the victory before the foundation of the world, that's what we mean. Before time is fabricated, the problem is already resolved in eternity. The use of time is serialization so that finite beings, individuated human beings, can, through the analytic process of temporal serialization, learn bit by bit what is too much for them to comprehend simultaneously, eternally. They're thrown down into the world to experience serial, moment by moment, ideational structures, one after the other, to see how they fit together. Because they're not quick enough to comprehend them.
Are you saying that before the world has run its course, and we're talking about Armageddon, God has decided who will and who will not?
We're back to Calvinism again. And 144,000 are already due to be saved. Those statements are symbolic. Those that are to be saved are human beings. Yeah? They're not carrots or stones. They're not insensate blocks. They're human beings. Now, a human being is a technical term. Not nothing. A being down at the level of physical body, pleasure, pain, serial mentation is not human. Right? So the election of grace is for those beings who comprehend. Right? and having comprehended, will to obey the comprehension, which puts them immediately in line with the purpose for which they were fabricated. Now, there's obviously at that level no difference between the will of the individual man and the will of the absolute for the individual man. And he is the elect. But it's perfectly obvious that if God wills to make reflexively self-conscious beings according to the words of Christ, is it not written, ye are gods? Every human being is a god. Now, do you elect yourself to be what you are, or do you prefer to go down?
Because every spirit coming into the time process that you were describing earlier on, that must be the beginning of their awareness of the necessity for the crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
But what goes wrong? Is it nothing but inertia?
Well, what goes wrong? What goes wrong is focus on externality.
Yes, that.
Nothing
else.
There's no other mystery than this. The will is absolute internality. The intellect is a formal structure around it, and physicality is a further structure around that. So the moment you start looking at what you call the gross physical body, this thing, you're already, if you allow yourself to believe that it is there, apart from the intent of consciousness, fallen. To fall is quite simple, to accept that as self-existent, instead of posited by intelligence. Because the moment you believe that, you're as bad as an empirical scientist. In the pursuit of truth, you will get hold of it and saw it into little bits. And you will formulate an atomic theory. And your little bits will be in space. Space for you will be void. It won't be spirit. Actually, it's spirit. But it will be void, and the little parts of metal that you saw on that, you will call atoms, and you will have to say they're moving about fortuitously within space, because you have de-spiritualized space.
Well, spirit has no inertia, then?
None at all. Spirit is immediate. Immediacy is the opposite of inertia.
At what point, in terms of the will, does the inertia start? At the point of willing to be
inertia. Immediately after it, you posit the form. You posit the form. The will posits that body.
And inertia.
It throws it down.
It even does anything. It must become inertia.
No, inertia means in work, doesn't it? There's a mysterious process in the will of the will. That process is catalytic and diabolic and down throwing. It throws the object down like that by looking at it. Just one wink of the eye and then it's an object. An Augenblick.
But that moment that object, that inertia.
At the moment it focuses on the object is inert.
Yes.
It has posited this inert object by looking at it. You do it in a Rorschach test, don't you?
Yes.
You get a bit of ink, you put it on, fold it over, you look at it, it's a mad bull charging at you, if you're nervous. On the other hand, it's a striptease girl waving her veils. Who knows what it is? It is what you will it to be. That's the meaning of the Rorschach test. That it reveals your hidden motivation. But it isn't there, is it really? All that is really there, in the case of the Rorschach test, is a piece of paper with ink on it. But your intent. I imagine that not only is this Rorschach test what it looks like, and it wasn't accidental, it was your a Rorschach chappie that utilised it and named it, that the universe itself is a Rorschach test. There is nothing there except vibrating infinite power, and each point of power vibrating interpenetrates with its waves all the others, and that's the hexonic field.
Well, is it a dialectic then that if you will anything, you've lost your will?
if you will anything, and forget you willed it. It's forgetting. Drink the waters of leaping. You shock yourself. You're like that fellow that did a statue of a lady and fell in love with it. On the other fellow that did a statue of a god and then fell down and worshipped it. It is possible to do that. I know a fellow that painted a picture of an African juju thing, put it on the wall and woke up in the middle of the night with a nightmare. And thought it was looking at him, it was so good. He'd done everything, he painted this picture to impress his friends, he put little lights along it, he got joss sticks and so on, made the room smell nice. What was he doing it for? He was going to frighten his friends. He fell asleep. He opened his eyes. What was he doing? The candles were flickering. Was it smelling the same? Or was it beginning to smell like a juju? In his fuzzy brain, his original motivation was beginning to objectify. It's quite easy to do that, isn't it? How many men that go about having been fed with muffins by a marvellous mum go around looking for the same shape and they see a rough approximation to it and they say, the source of muffins. Suddenly they're slipping a ring on a finger. It's supposed to be on her finger. Why does she accept it? She knows if he puts it on in public, it's his. Some careless thinkers make him wear one as well. He doesn't need to, he's wearing it if that one's on there. In the eyes of the public. And if he's looking for a muffin-type mum, certainly will not break out of the comprehensive grasp of society as a body, will he? So, the will posits, and it does it without doing anything. The very latest experiments in this investigation into processes inside the psyche show that something happens in an act of will which does not alter the pattern of the brainwave. It actually doesn't disturb an alpha rhythm, which is basic. So there's something there that is not energy in the ordinary physical sense. It is catalytic consciousness. Will does not mean releasing gross energy and pushing and urging. Will is a slight sparkle in the eye. Nothing else. Did you see Official 38 as a film years ago, Bob? About the Greek god Zeus coming to earth to seduce ladies. And it showed him in heaven. And before he came down to earth, he had a little pipette and he put divine sparkle in his eyes. Then he went down to earth. Whatever lady he did that to, they promptly started getting ready because of the eye sparkle. Now that eye sparkle was just a reference to this Wunderhauer, this fact that the consciousness of God, the infinite consciousness of God, is called a wonder eye because, what does it do? It posits forms and wounds itself. Wonder and wounding are the same word. Because you posit this thing, it's a wound inside you. And it's wound round. And you wind the consciousness around it. You're okay, provided you remember, I'm doing it. I am so fascinating. Fascinating means binding, doesn't it? And if you forget and say, what a marvelous thing, I wonder who made it. I'd better own it. Who's about? I'll treasure it. I'll put it in my safe account. It's so beautiful, I'll have to wrap it up so it doesn't get rusty. And put it in the bank so it doesn't get lost. And I'll keep thinking about it. I know people who do that. I know one woman, the whole of her jewellery is in the bank. She hasn't worn it for 50 years. But she's thought about it every day. And another one that's got a mink coat, 3,000 quid. She wore it once to prove to me that she'd got it, and then put it in the wardrobe. Right? Good? Think of that self-fascination. And the woman, the mink, is quite clever. She says, I know it's no good. I know it's only a mink. So I'm not really trapped. Not much. The whole art of all religion consists in this. Becoming aware that you posit your universe. Sounds silly, doesn't it? Looking from where I am, all you people are posited by the same consciousness which posits this body, the same consciousness. But all those different bodies are unique in their configurations externally and internally. And they're posited by this field, this non-dual field, posits all these different organisms. So they're absolutely non-different in essence, but absolutely unique in form and function. If I identify with the consciousness, all those organisms are mine. If I think they're not mine, but this one is, I'm fallen. Simple. Now, who's going to mind the baby tonight? If that is so, I could mind it. And so it should be, I could even let you mind it when I go to the pictures. I wouldn't feel bad about it. Because there is only this supreme, non-dual, absolute sentient power which has made all these organisms. What's the good of kicking and biting and scratching? Can you imagine a little bunch of wavelets going along in the ocean, coming to another little bunch of wavelets and shouting, enemy, and crashing into it and trying to smash it? What happens in such a case? That's a model of America and Vietnam, isn't it? Have they cured anybody? Have they changed anybody's mind? Have they dominated them? You mean the native sharpness that was in the beings,
yes,
under the stimulus has become more itself? Yes? So the most you could do for somebody would be to convince them that they are what they are. And you could never get them to kneel down and thank you for saving them and keeping the world free for democracy. So the otherness, the misconception that there is an other, a separated being, it's a convenience for sharpening ourselves up. No, you haven't. You can't even guarantee that. At the moment of their annihilation, what has happened is their business. And you have to deal with them on the reincarnation. And if you knock them out too soon, they come back immediately. Often in your line instead of theirs. It is automatic that when a hero kills another being, he identifies with that being, and he has to do a penance.
So what happens then when you
But just think that when they were putting their viewpoint, they were apologizing. Didn't they say they dropped those things to defend their buddies?
Yeah.
They had to have an excuse. And they know inside themselves, in the will of the will, don't they, whether they would actually do for their buddy what they say for their buddy. Do they really do it for the buddy? There's a fellow napalm a little village because some so-called communist has just shot one of his friends. Is it true? Not at all, and he knows it. He knows that the depth of his being is riddled with ancestral rage and qualitatively reinforced by his rage against the limitations imposed on him by him, by accepting the restraints imposed on him by the society in which he lives. He knows that. Those men don't even sound as if they're telling the truth. How can they? The being internally knows what it is saying and why. It knows that it posits what it says by act of will. It knows that the reason it offers you in its pattern is an act of will. It knows the justification of it in serial conversation is an act of will. And it knows that the like and dislike that arise in it and the physical price to pay for it are the products of that act of will. That is the end of a process, like a reflection of the old days of heroes, isn't it? Yeah. Everything goes in cycles, and things recur and recur and recur. So the Knights of the Round Table is like a repetition of some other knights long ago, isn't it? Like the Bushido in Japan, or the great Mithras in ancient Persia. It's cycling. And when that vanishes, it just shrinks down. It's still there as a seed because it has exhausted its significance for the time being. When we say, if you see a thing the first time, you don't know you've seen it. You see it for the second time, you have an image that says you might have seen it before. You see it for the third time, you verify it. In 100 years, there are roughly 3 generations. Each generation does this process. Posit something, not know that you've done it. Do it again and get a feeling of reminiscence. Do it the third time, you're sure about it. Start the next trio of generations, the next century. So that each century the concept changes. You've only got one lifetime, that's the interesting thing. Yeah? Because your life is eternal. And you never, ever had for life anything other than here now. In eternity it was here now. In time you've got here now. In every here now you posit something. If with it you reposit something you posited before in the here now in order to remember it, you complicate your here now in order to examine and compare. But you never had anything other than here now.
So what happened to the hierarchy then?
You mean the face hierarchy in the illusory time process?
Yeah.
It diminishes and vanishes and reappears again. Turn the Arthurian cycle, you see that the Knights of the Round Table vanish, don't they? The king is killed. But it tells you he must come again, doesn't it? Arthur will reappear. Arthur is really Hathura, law. It is repetition. It always gives itself 12 disciplines, the signs of the zodiac, the 12 tribes, the 12 Knights of the Table. Always the same process. The hierarchy appears, manifests, people look at it, decide whether they like it or not, and it goes down. Why does it go down? Because if it were presented to you and stayed there, you'd have no alternative but to accept it. It would be an imposition. If it's offered to you and then shrinks and vanishes, you can make up your mind whether you wish to reposit it in you. Christ says this when he says, if I do not go, the comforter cannot come. I have to remove myself before you will stand in an inner decision of your own. But when that decision is made by the individual's consciousness returns into that space and reposits itself again. Every child that sees a parent doing something efficiently will tend to copy that efficient act. And if the parent carries on doing that efficient act, the child will tend to keep copying the parent. But if, having done that perfect act, the parent sees the child copy it, and then the parent does this week's deliberate mistake, what does the child say immediately? Mummy, you've done it wrong. Doesn't it? That's the beginning of the child positing it. And if at that moment the mother said, wrong, there's no such thing as wrong, the child would go into chaos. But if the act was right, and the mother says, thank you for that, I forgot about that, the child thinks, I remembered the right way. I educated mummy. He reinforces it. And the next time mummy does it right, the kid thinks, I'm the cause of her rightness. He gets another lesson to learn. Did you notice the inevitability in her face? As opposed to the crying child with one leg off. What was the child crying about? Why was the mother sitting there as if this kind of thing happens in war? But the child was crying. Why? It's not a bad analysis, is it?
Well, it's certainly our thought of it, and I thought, my God, they
might just
the
chance when
they
reached
the coast,
and
the Americans.
Well, didn't they go into Minnie's and start
collaborating?
Perhaps you're looking at those legs and saying, this is what you get for fraternizing, and liking it. Or it might have been something quite different. When you do an analysis like that, you have to be careful that you don't dogmatize. Supposing that when these two were put together, a woman with two legs off and the baby with one, supposing somebody said diddums to the baby and not to the mother. What do you think the child does? The absent leg has become a weapon. Isn't it? And how about the motivation of this woman that's lost her legs? What was her life like when she had a pair? Hard work. She was getting something. You see, it's highly complex. She might have thought, well, I deserve that for fraternizing. But she might not have thought that at all. She might have thought, legs off. No further work, heroism, perhaps even the grave. Perhaps she's a Buddhist, reincarnation. The complexity of her motivations, you cannot analyze except hypothetically, can you? Unless you talk to that woman individually, face to face, with really intimate cross-questioning. So that the solution that you come to and stick on has something to do with you. When you say this is the solution, you're really talking about yourself, as you identify yourself in the situation. And you see how easy it is to fall. Something happens, and if you don't watch it, you take an attitude. And if you're not careful, you'll think the attitude is correct. You'll think that you have a right analysis, and then you've made a fall. And you forget that you've posited the form, you've posited the analysis, you've made the right. But you go under the law governing the form with which you identify. So whatever you say about a thing, whatever analysis you give, if you stand there and say, this is the truth, immediately you start processes inside yourself to teach yourself a lesson. The ultimate is absolute freedom. His worship is perfect freedom, it says in the prayer book. Perfect freedom. That is freedom gained reflexively. It's not any old freedom. You can imagine a state called free by changing the word free to unconditioned. Now imagine infinite power moving at random, which is conceivable, and imagine it with no conditions whatever upon it. Call that free. Now, is it perfect? Can't be. Because perfect means realize factually in reason, and the reason realized factually. His worship is perfect freedom. That is to say, freedom. Self-positing, self-limitation, self-formulation, factually realized. Hegel's idea, the real is the rational is the real, would have been perfect if he had said, and this real, rational, rational, real is posited by a will which is absolute, which is free, and which is in the individual that it posits exactly to the same degree it is in itself. And then that would have meant that instead of being pawns in the system, every human being would have been God again. Now you're changing the meaning of the word one life to one temporal life in one body. You must be doing. Because if there's only one life, that doesn't mean that that one life can't mask itself in millions of ways, does it?
No.
You can pull faces that you haven't pulled before.
Well, you can tell in the life of the death life story.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are you saying now? You come in at the birth point, you're referring to time, aren't you?
Yes.
So you're talking about temporal life.
Time is an
eternity. Now, if you had only one temporal life, then anything you saw, you'd be seeing for the first time, wouldn't you?
I don't
mean so you must be positing yourself before birth as already existent. So then you'd be agreeing possibly with Plato that you've already seen everything before you enter time.
Yes.
So it wouldn't be surprising if you recognised something.
No.
That simple resonance.
Yes.
But then this deja vu concept, I've already seen it. There's another explanation possible. When you look at a thing, you can actually feed it back into your brain like that within a split second so that you see it twice. Although you've never seen it before in time, you've seen it twice now. You send the message through the brain, you send it around twice without noticing, and you have a sensation of recognition through immediate feedback. You think you've seen it before in time, and you haven't. You've seen it by immediate feedback. That also is an explanation. If you come down on any finite explanation about anything, you're fallen again. It's absolutely essential to recognize that. Dogmatism is for dogs. That's not a joke. A dogma is for believing. Doggies are called Fido. Fido, I believe. A dogma is formulated by an intelligence to keep in order those that can be kept in order by a fixated opinion. Hasn't got any other use. It's for the unfree to keep them tidy.
Yes.
That's right.
You don't need to have any sympathy, because it's a
Beware of pity, said Nietzsche. What would pity do for you if you had it?
It would
be regressive. Pity is one of the worst poisons in the world. Self-pity, conscious self-pity, is worse, isn't it? Because that's negative feedback of the lowest order. You can't get lower than self-pity. Somebody else pitying you, you can think, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about. It's useful to let him pity me because maybe he'll give me a banana. But if you do it yourself, that's really the bottom. Well, a dogma is something you mustn't analyze. The dogma is laid down for you by the priestcraft, not to be thought about. You take this on trust and you must not analyze it. That's the essence of a dogma. You are not to break it down. The priest has made it for you and you are not to fiddle about with it. For instance, the mystery of the Trinity. Don't think about it. Just take it. That's a dogma. But if you say, here is a statement. God the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. The Father is power, and the power itself is the will of the Absolute, which we can talk about, feel for, but in itself, the will of the will, we cannot verbalize. The Son of that Father is the formulation made by the will for its own self-objectification. The Holy Ghost is the functionalizing of that precipitated form by the power of the will that precipitated the form. These three, simultaneously, co-present, mutually interpenetrating, not to be confounded or mixed together, and not to be substantially divided, constitute a meaning which, if you think about it, analyze it, break it down, reassemble it as many times as you like. You will enrich yourself progressively and you will find out that you are the temple of the living God. Because when you use your intellect, if there is a truth in it, like a triangle has three sides, that truth belongs to God the Son, because God the Son is the form of truth posited by the Father. If there is a function, like waving or something else, or writing a book, whatever the function is, it is a function which is nothing but the dynamized, serialized, kinetic movement of the power formulating. And the will to do it is the generative power of it. And this is as true for you as it is for God. So if you want to go and worship in the cellar, or up a ladder, or swimming in the sea every morning, whatever you do, posited by your will, formulated by you, functionalized by you, it is an absolute right and a divine act for you to do it.